Olaso. So we're coming to the end of this chapter on parables. So we'll pick up with the end on page 94. This is not really a parable, but a very classic analogy. The analogy of gold. So take the analogy of uncontaminated pure gold. If a goldsmith were to sweep it into a dog dish or grime and it was covered with dirt, it would become filthy. But after melting it down, it could be made into beautiful ornaments such as a golden adorned saddle, earrings, bracelets, or rings. Or melting them down, it could be molded into a statue of the Buddha. And when that was consecrated, it could become an object of homage and a worship for everyone. Although there are these three things that can be done to it, the essence of gold is immutable. So this is a nice analogy. Of course, it's really classic. But we have the manifest nature of a lump of gold, and we have its essential nature. Nice, very straightforward analogy, right? And the manifest nature is, oh, that gold is yucky, it stinks, it has dog poop all over it, and so forth. You know, how does it look? Ooh, I don't want to touch it. It's really stinky. Right? Oh, look, oh, that's a beautiful golden statue. Oh, those are nice golden earrings you have. So the form, the manifest nature is what it looks like, right? It's how it appears to you. And of course, the essential nature of it, whether it's covered in filth or whether it's manifested into a Buddha statue, its essential nature is always the same. So it's a very, very useful analogy, very close analogy here. So although these three things can be done to it, the essence of gold or its essential nature is immutable. It's just no matter what you do to it, it's gold. That's why, again, you'll recall the second type of bodhicitta on the Mahayana path of accumulation is called gold-like bodhicitta. Because that will always be the nature of your mind. You'll never revert to something that's not gold. Your mind will never revert to something less than bodhicitta. So likewise, all the time that we wander in samsara, achieve the bodhisattva grounds and paths, and ultimately attain spiritual awakening, the essence of the mind is immutable. Just as the ordinary stone, and we can just pause there for a second. Here's a fundamental difference between the Gelugpa and Dzogchen views on Buddha nature and Dharmakaya. And if I make a mistake, Glenn, I hope you'll correct me because my little bit rusty on Gelugpa. But from what I recall from my studies 30 years ago or so, the Buddha nature, again, Tsongkhapa writing, as if from the perspective of a sentient being like myself does not have one quality of a Buddha, not even one. I have all the qualities of a sentient being and no qualities of a Buddha. Therefore, I am 100% sentient being, 0% Buddha, but I do, like every other sentient being, including insects, we find out, have Buddha nature. Right, but Buddha nature is a potential. It's the capacity to become Buddha. And so we have the Ranjin Nirik, the naturally abiding Buddha nature. And this is the really often referred to as the emptiness of the nature of the mind itself. Ranjin Nirik means it's always there, it's always present, and it's immutable. And it's always present. Well, this would be the empty nature. And then the Gyegyurgi Rik, then the evolving Buddha nature. The evolving Buddha nature is that which manifests over time as we cultivate, we purify, cultivate, purify. We reach the path, we move along the path, we achieve the first bhumi, and so on. So those two. And then the culmination of the path is when your mind transforms into Dharmakaya. Right? And Dharmakaya is also understood to be arising independence upon causes and conditions moment to moment to moment. Even the ultimate mind is considered to be not impermanent in the sense it will ever become not Dharmakaya, but impermanent in the sense that, like every other state of consciousness, it's arising from moment to moment to moment to moment. That sounds familiar to you? Yeah? Okay, good. My memory's not too feeble yet. And then, bearing in mind, we're not setting this up as a debate. Any more than we should debate on whether light is really a wave or a particle. It's just a silly debate. And now we just shift perspective over to that of Longchenpa, of Padmasambhava, and so forth, writing, speaking, presenting the path as if from the perspective of Buddha mind. And there, of course, it's looking at the same person, for example, but now seeing the person as a Buddha, right now as a Buddha, So that's one point, that your Buddha nature is not a potential, it's who you actually are, always. And the notion that you are a sentient being is something simply concocted out of ignorance and delusion. But then also very importantly, that the nature of Dharmakaya, of Rigpa itself, Tathagata Garbha, all of this, unborn, unceasing, unchanging, totally beyond time, beyond space, and therefore not arising moment to moment to moment. Right? So then we say, well, they disagree. Yes, of course they disagree. They're looking from different perspectives. So there's no reason to start a debate. They're simply looking from different perspectives. So I think that's actually a good point, because one may start a debate there, which I think is completely pointless. So the essence of the mind is immutable, beyond change. The essence of the mind is Dharmakaya. It's immutable, unchanging. And I think if we're trying to make sense of all of this, the ground, the path of fruition, using what we have, and what we have is our sentient beings' minds. If we're using that as our platform, trying to make sense of, to comprehend the nature of the path and its fruition, then really my mind can't wrap itself around, my intellect can't now wrap itself around the notion of there being a mind. So a Dharmakaya, just see if you can do this. I can't do it. Maybe you can. Can you conceive of an ultimate mind, a Dharmakaya, mind of all the Buddhas, that, let alone, okay, but can you try to do that? Okay, go with me, because the answer is no, we can't. But but you know, try to approximate. You can approximate, you know, understanding emptiness, even if you've not nailed it completely, right? So can you imagine now an ultimate mind, Dharmakaya, which is constantly manifesting as Sambhogakaya, right, to the Arya Bodhisattvas and other Buddhas, and manifesting in myriad ways, like the moon casting its reflection on a thousand, a million, or a trillion pools of water, effortlessly, and so active throughout the universe, serving the needs of sentient beings, this dynamo, this infinite capacity of creativity, awareness that saturates all of space and time, compassion that is equal for all sentient beings, can you imagine that is immutable? I mean, when I think of immutable, I think immutable. It doesn't change. So how does something that doesn't change keep on coming out with more emanations? You know, and we're praying. We're not praying because we're stupid. You know, it's not a stupid thing. When Christians pray, it's not stupid. When Mahayana Buddhists are praying, it's not stupid. And so we're invoking, calling for the blessings of the Buddhas. Well, if their minds were immutable, How could they respond? It would be like talking to a rock, but like, you know, an immutable rock, more rocky than rock. And so it just doesn't compute. From my mind, it just doesn't compute. I can't even imagining that, right? And so then Tsongkhapa says, well, let yourself off the hook. Imagine that it's impermanent. Oh, okay, now I can start to imagine it. I'm fooling myself because I can't really, but at least I can make some sense of it, you know, that the Buddhas respond. They respond to the suffering of sentient beings. They respond with compassion. They give teachings. They manifest here. They manifest there. They engage with each other and so forth. Okay, if they're impermanent, then they can do stuff. But if they're absolutely immutable, how can something that's immutable do anything at all? So here we are, sentient beings. Okay, now that makes sense. But then Padmasambhava, Longchenpa, they say, whatever you think about the Dharmakaya from the perspective of your mind, you're going to get it wrong no matter what. So I don't want to give you the confidence that you kind of got it right because you didn't. So just give it a rest, basta, and release your mind and come down here where Dharmakaya can see Dharmakaya, where Rigpa ascertains Rigpa. And don't try to mess, don't mess with it. It's beyond your pay grade. You know, it's beyond the scope, beyond the imagination. So don't fool yourself with the thought that, you know, you can imagine it. There is a bit of irony, and it's just really healthy irony, that in the classic teachings, and not just Tsongkhapa, it's in the classic teachings, I think it must be in the Abhisamalankara, there's a list of the qualities, the classic qualities of Dharmakaya. Andy, do you remember how many there are? I mean, the speech, I think 60, the body, 32 major, 80 minor, and of the mind, there's a list. 110? 121
categories.
Sounds probably more like 21. 21. So something like that. I mean, we could be right. Maybe your guess is as good as mine. So here, there's a list. Here are the 21 qualities, let's say, of a Buddha mind. I remember there are different types of fearlessness. Remember? Four types of fearlessness. So you have this list of the qualities of the Buddha mind, and then I remember one of them, inconceivable. out of 21, one is inconceivable, which means, wait a minute, doesn't that negate all the others in terms of actually being able to capture it with the mind of a sentient being? Okay? So it's good to, not drive down dead ends of debate and thinking there's controversy where there isn't any. No meaningful controversy. So we continue on. Just as an ordinary stone does not turn into silver even if it is melted down, if the essence of spiritual awakening, Buddha nature, were not present in the causal mind stream, the fruition of spiritual awakening would not be accomplished even with the practice of Dharma. If you didn't have Buddha mind, you can practice Dharma all you like. You'll never become a Buddha. It is said all phenomena arise from causes. Since silver is present in silver ore, when it is melted down, it first becomes partially refined, then more refined, and finally it turns into pure silver. And likewise, since the Sugata-garbha is present in the mind stream, once we know this and enter into practice, first experiential realization arises, then we gradually progress along the bodhisattva grounds and paths, and finally we attain spiritual awakening. That's a very juicy statement and very strong parallel, really juicy parallel. And I'll just unpack it, I'll just tease a little bit more out of it. He said first experimental realization arises. In the classic Dzogchen teachings, specifically those of Duchum Lingba in his Pure Visions, he gives actually four stages, which I found very, very helpful, very practical. And that is, we're first introduced to, for example, to the Dzogchen view, meditation and way of life, first of all, as we listen to teachings, and maybe we read books, as I did when I was 20, reading the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation on Dzogchen. First we read, and then we reflect upon, we try to make sense of, maybe we have question and answer and so forth, but we ponder it, contemplate it, maybe investigate it, analyze it, and out of that, out of those two first phases of hearing and thinking, comes what Tibetans call koa, understanding. And that is, if you read some books on Dzogchen, maybe receive some teachings, and somebody comes to you and says, I've heard of Dzogchen, do you know, what's that? What's Dzogchen about? You could actually say things that were meaningful and accurate, and not just what you've memorized, a parrot can memorize, but without just simply memorizing, you could rephrase it in your own terms, you could convey it, and if there were a great Dzogchen master listening to you, that person might very well say, well, good, that was accurate. You've clearly demonstrated, you've understood what the Dzogchen view, meditation, way of life are about. Not that hard, actually. The difference between Svatantrika and Prasangika, that's kind of hard. But Dzogchen, it's not hard to just give the talk, not that complicated. So that's goa, that's understanding. And that's really worth something. But then you're not going to stop there with hearing and thinking and the understanding the understanding that arises from that. But then you go to meditation, as we've been doing over these last 8 weeks. And in meditation, as you're actually putting the teachings into practice, then there arises nyamma. You know the term, meditative experiences. Meditative experiences. And many of you, perhaps even all of you, in your meetings with me, you've experienced, I think all of you have, you've shared your nyam. What happened? What happened? What came up? Sometimes pleasant, unpleasant, sometimes a real spike, a breakthrough, a flash, an intuition. But meditative experiences arise. They write very rarely and sporadically if you don't practice at all. They might just flash up once in a while, then they just vanish away. But if you're practicing, then these nyam, the meditative experiences, arise more and more, deeper and deeper, stemming from a deeper source. And then if you continue practicing, then there arises dokpa. And dokpa is realization. A nyam is an experience. I had an experience. And as a result of your experience, what do you know? What do you know decisively? Beyond any doubt, that is with certainty, what do you know? Out of it? Because often people have experiences and they say, Alan, could you tell me what I experienced? Can you contextualize that? Was that separate? Was it rikpa? Was it emptiness? Was it just a flight of imagination? Was I just spacing out? So they've had an experience, but very understandably, they don't know what it meant. They don't know what they may or may not have ascertained at that time. So it remains an experience. And then you come to somebody who hopefully has a bit of experience and understanding. You clarify, and then you go, and then you do that, not just say, okay, that's what I've got, but okay, that's a plausible hypothesis, perhaps. And then you go back to the experience, and you keep on deepening the experience until there comes a point when you don't need to ask anybody. You know. It's like, it really is, I mean, the image that comes to my mind really strongly is, you got a nail and a piece of wood, you take out a good big hammer, and you whack it. And we say in American English, probably British English also, you nailed it. You nailed it. That's what we say. If somebody gives, you know, if there's a complex question and somebody comes right through, he nailed it. Or that fellow who solved Fermat's last theorem, you know, in 130 pages, solved this theorem that had been around for like 300 years. He nailed it, apparently. He nailed it. He got it. And he knew he got it. And then other, you know, peer review, and then they knew he got it. And then he gets a big prize for it. And so that's realization. But then realization can fade. It's not necessarily the case that if you realize something, you will have that realization irreversibly for the rest of this and all future lives. So realization of the third one, then finally comes dengtopa, achieving or acquiring confidence, literally confidence. It's a very special type of confidence. And many of you heard me give the analogy, which I must say I like a lot. And that is, if you gain realization, it's like taking a big hammer on a piece of wood and hitting it so hard that the head of the nail goes right down flush to the wood. And just one big bang and wham! And it's gone all the way in, right to the top of the nail, the head of the nail, and it's flush to the surface of the wood, right? Boy, you really nailed it. You really nailed it. But now you can imagine, if I push that analogy, somebody with a hammer with the prongs could say, well, let's see if I can pull that out. And they might be able to, just one, and it's gone. You nailed it, and now it's unnailed, right? Could happen. People gain realization, and they still fade. It can happen, right? So what do you want to do then? You want to fortify your realization with shamatha. You want to fortify your realization with vipassana, with shamatha. And here's the metaphor I really like. You countersink the nail. So anybody who doesn't know what that means, you brought the nail down all with flush with the surface of the wood. You take a little pin, a strong pin, put it right on top of the head of the nail, and then you whack it. And so the head of the nail goes down beneath the surface of the wood. And then maybe you cover it over with putty to make a nice smooth surface, if it's a cabinet or something. But you've countersunk the nail, so the head of it is deep inside the wood. Now, apart from just shredding the wood completely, destroying the wood, you're never going to get that nail out. Right? It's countersunk. That's dengtopa. It's gone so deeply that you'll just never make that mistake again. It's like having a flash that I'm not Napoleon, but then thinking maybe I am, but again, pretty not. But, yeah, no, I'm not. And then just getting to the point where I'll just never, ever think I'm Napoleon again because it's so transparent, it's silly, doesn't even have to be talked about. And even if 1,000 people said I'm Napoleon, I just have to tell them all, you're all wrong. Even if the whole world tells you you're Napoleon, you just tell the whole world you're wrong because you know what you're talking about. Right? It's helpful in the world we're living in now to gain such deep insight that even if the greatest authorities at Oxford and MIT and Cambridge and Harvard and so forth, tell you, you have no free will, you know, which they may very well do. Your mind is your brain, or you are this, you are this, and so forth. They do speak with a lot of authority, and they are very intelligent, and they do have a strong database. That doesn't mean they're right. And so when you know something with certitude, yeah, it doesn't matter what other people say. And it's kind of knowing thyself. You know, I've known a number of exceptional yogis and lamas, and they just don't care what you think about them. You know, if you think they're just fabulous, they're Arya Bodhisattvas, they're Buddhas, they're the greatest whatever in the world, they don't really care. It doesn't give them a buzz. And if you just think they're complete idiots, heading a cult, egomaniacs, and so forth, it doesn't really matter. Like, call me a tomato, call me a giraffe. You can if you like. Tomato? Giraffe? They're not going for it. But, you know, You call me a tomato or a giraffe, I'm going to have the same response. No, no, like that. I'm not one of those highly realized, but I've set much people, they just don't care. So they have nothing to show, nothing to prove. That's helpful. Then you feel very relaxed. Oh, that's all. So the, and then to back up his statement with this great source, the profound inner meaning states, the stainless essence of the jhanas is sequentially impure, partially pure, and utterly pure. Likewise, it is said that it is sequentially present as sentient beings and as tathagatas. So the Buddha nature manifests as sentient beings, ordinary sentient beings who have achieved the path, sentient beings who become Arya Bodhisattvas, and then sentient beings who are no longer sentient beings, they become tathagatas, and they become Buddha. But it was that same piece of gold all the way through. And we can say, one can say, well, when a sentient being, somebody who killed 35 people, or was a racist, or a terrorist, or whatever, it's still gold. And they just have a bit more to purify it at the beginning. But it's the same all the way through. So that's what this business is about, right, from the Zen tradition. That you can be focusing, and really you should. If you meet a mass murderer or somebody other, you know, war criminal, you can go like this to them. Because you're not saluting, you're not showing respect for what they've done, their manifest nature. Right? That may or may not deserve respect. Sometimes it doesn't even deserve respect. Right? Not at all. Because there's nothing to respect there. But we're looking right through the manifest nature to the essential nature, and then whoever it is, you know, it's whether ants, whether it's birds, crickets, and so forth, is it called Gassho? Gassho? Gassho is, of course, to that nature. So thus, the ultimate reality of the mind is primordially present as the essence of the Dhammakaya. So identify and recognize it with certainty. So this is, again, just your first, middle, and final thing to do in Dzogchen. So that with that identification and recognition, then you speed right along in warp drive from hyperspace or whatever metaphor you like, through the path of accumulation, through the path of preparation, which would otherwise take an immensely long time. You just warp drive through it up to becoming a Vidyadhara. So identify and recognize it with certainty and without modifying or adulterating it. With any hopes or fears, it is enough simply to attend to the essence of whatever appears. So there he just gave you the essence of Dzogchen meditation. You're simply resting in Rigpa. You're not activating, crucial point, it's really simple, you're not activating your mind at all. Your samsaric mind, the mind that isn't a Buddha mind, that would like to progress and one day achieve Buddha. You're not giving it the microphone. You're not giving it a script. It's just, you've just put it out of work. Not doing. You're not even letting it meditate. You're saying your task now is not meditation and not anything else either. And then you simply rest in Rigpa with no hope, no fear. And then whatever arises, because this is not imploding into the substrate or imploding into someplace away from appearances. It's utterly open to all appearances. But whatever arises, one attends to the essence, not the drama. Not the manifestation. The essence, of course, is Dhamma Dhatu. So you're just sustaining that awareness of resting in Rigpa and realizing Dhamma Dhatu, the essential nature. Right? And of course, as you cut through and see not only all these phenomena are empty of inherent nature, but as you're resting more and more deeply, that is with fewer and fewer obscurations or veils, resting in Rigpa, then you simultaneously see that all these appearances are empty of inherent nature, and while empty of inherent nature, they are nothing other than effulgences of your own pristine awareness. Bear in mind, when saying your own pristine awareness, it doesn't mean your own private one. It just means not anyone else's, right? Because your own, so-called, pervades all of reality. And so then you see empty and equally pure whatever arises from the center of your mala to the center of your mandala, it's all just expressions of Rigpa. As an analogy, after forming sugar into various divine forms, Nowadays, I'm sure he would have said chocolate, but they didn't have chocolate, so I have to stick with sugar. As an analogy, after forming sugar into various divine forms, demonic forms, and human forms, when they are eaten one after the other, even though their forms are different, they all have the same sweet taste of sugar. Similarly, whatever virtuous and non-virtuous thoughts arise in the mind, by observing their essence, which means by observing their emptiness of inherent nature, and their essence in the sense of that from which they are flowing, that of which they are the nature, and that is Rigpa. Observing their essence is seeing them as empty and seeing them as displays of Rigpa. By seeing that, by observing their essence, they arise as Mahamudra, just as all the different forms of sugar have the same sweet taste. This concludes the supplementary introduction to parables. And Gyatrodhammacca has a very helpful commentary here, which I invite you to read. Very, very worthwhile. From one of the great lineage holders of this tradition. So let's go from there to meditation. Taking refuge and arousing the motivation of bodhicitta, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states. Then let your eyes be softly open. Release your awareness into space evenly without an object. Release any notion of the mind or your awareness being inside your head or behind your eyes. Release any notion of head. Just release your awareness into space, with no center, with no periphery. No sense of there being a body, just appearances arising in space. Intangible, empty, insubstantial, somatic, visual, auditory appearances, arising from space, dissolving back into space. All all of them nameless. Just empty appearances. And simply rest without doing anything. Again, recall the four not doings: without desire, without striving, without modification, without doing. And simply being aware, sustaining the flow of clarity and cognizance. Aware of whatever appearances arise by way of the all six sense doors. Resting in the stillness of your awareness in the midst of the movements of appearances and observing, attending to their essential nature without grasping, without revocation. Your best approximation here and now. Of resting in Rigpa and observing empty appearances that spontaneously emerge from Rigpa. whenever your awareness has wandered off, you're already in the post-meditative state. You're not practicing incorrectly. You're just not doing the practice at all. So relax, release whatever carried you away, and return to the non-meditation of Dzogchen. Then with your eyes open or closed if you wish, imagine yourself spontaneously emerging, effortlessly emerging from this ground of the primordial non-duality of Dharmadhatu and Dharmakaya as a spontaneous actualization of this ground. Imagine taking on form. It may, if you wish, be an archetypal form, such as Vajrayogini or Avalokiteshvara, Avatara, as you wish. But if you prefer, manifest in your form, your familiar form, but purified, like purified gold, so with no sense of revocation of substantiality. Hollow, pure, radiant, glowing, as you would see yourself with pure vision, perhaps. As an effulgence of your own Buddha nature, which you visualize as this orb of radiant light at your heart. And now for the remaining minutes of this session, we come to the culmination of this path of the four immeasurables, the four greats, the extraordinary resolve. And finally, from ultimate bodhicitta, of resting in Rigpa, there spontaneously arises relative bodhicitta. Arouse the aspiration and the resolve. For the sake of all sentient beings throughout all realms of existence, to relieve them, to free them from all suffering, to bring them to the immutable state of bliss of awakening. For that purpose, I shall achieve perfect awakening of a Buddha. And may the gurus and the deities bless me that it may be so, that I may be so enabled. With prayers of supplication to your objects of refuge, as you've done before, with each in-breath, imagine a reality rising up to meet you in the form of rays of light from all the enlightened ones converging upon your body, speech, and mind. And with every out-breath, breathe out the light of bodhicitta. Imagine the light taking on form and leading each sentient being according to their needs along the path to their own perfect awakening. Breathe in, breathe out. venturing boldly into the realm of possibility. Imagine here and now. All sentient beings realizing perfect awakening, manifesting their essential nature. Pure gold. Bring to mind all sentient beings, not only as some generic idea, but all the sentient beings you know or know of. Imagine seeing them with pure vision, so you see right through to their essence. And now imagine all of the manifestations of the Buddhas, Manjushri, Tara, Avalokiteshvara, all forms of enlightened beings, all converging in upon you, like snowflakes falling upon a lake and dissolving into you. As you imagine yourself to be an embodiment of all the Buddhas, adopting this divine pride, this pure vision, as you breathe in, imagine this convergence, as you breathe out, stabilize the divine pride and pure vision of yourself as primordially awakened, manifestly awakened. Then release all appearances, all objects of the mind, and rest in the primordial stillness and clarity of your own awareness. So there's a meditation you can return to again and again if you wish. And if you engage in that type of meditation or meditative equipoise, it would be good to know what you practice in the post-meditative state. And that's very simple. To the best of your ability, continue viewing reality from that perspective. Whatever appearances, see them as forms of the Buddha, Nimanakaya, expressions of Nimanakaya. Whatever sounds as the speech of the Buddha, whatever mental activities as displays of Dharmakaya. Pretty simple. Do enjoy your day.